Welcome everyone to the sitter class for today. So the last few weeks I've been doing some classes on the Jataka stories, and for this week I'd like to, and probably this will be the last story. Originally I planned to do four classes, and we, by popular demand, we had another one. Well, somebody, one person said, let's do some more, so that's popular. That's popular enough for me. It's already fairly exceptional. And in the past, once we had this kind of theme, and then we had last week, we did the Kusa Jataka, which is a very magnificent one, and we just did that one for the whole thing. Now, for now, I'm just going to read a few more or less random ones, okay? So it's not going to be as structured as it was previously, but there's just a few which may possibly be of interest. But I also want to ask, is there any particular themes or things which anybody is interested in or would like to follow up more in that? So, for example, some of the things we talked about the parallels with Greek mythology in the Jatakas. That's one kind of topic. Another one would be the attitudes to women, was another thing we talked about. Or were there any other topics that you'd like to follow up on?
The irrational desires of men.
The what?
The irrational desires of men.
Is
another one?
Isn't that an oxymoron? Oh, irrational men in the same sense.
I don't know, men all seem to behave perfectly sensibly. We can do that. We can have someone the irrational desires of men. It's not quite the same, but yeah. Okay, well, here's one about the desires of men. But this is about Buddha told while staying at Jetavana about a monk who was addicted to covetousness. And the Buddha told him, not only now, brother, are you greedy, but in the olden days your greed caused you to have your head cut off. Once upon a time, when Brahmadatta was king over Benares, the Bodhisattva was born as his son. He grew up and finished his education at Takasila. On his father's death, he inherited the kingdom, and he was very dainty in his eating. Accordingly, he earned the name of King Dainty. There was so much extravagance about his eating that on one dish he spent $100,000. When he ate not within doors, but as he wished to confer merit upon many people by showing them the costly array of his meals, he caused a pavilion adorned with jewels to be set up at the door, and at the time of eating he had this decorated, and there he sat upon a royal throne made all of gold under a white parasol with princesses all around him, and ate the food of 100 delicate flavours from a dish which cost 100,000 pieces of money. So that's quite interesting, isn't it? He did all that specifically to do it outdoors so that people could see him eating. So presumably so that they think, you know, this man must have been so generous and kind in his past lives, that's why he's had such good merit as to be able to get this good food. So why don't we go out and do good? But then a certain greedy man saw the king's manner of eating and desired to have a taste. Unable to master his craving, he girt up his loins and ran to the king, calling out loudly, "Messenger, messenger, O king," with his hands held up. And it has a little note in the text here. At that time and in that nation, if a man called out messenger, no one would stop him. And so it was that the multitude divided and gave him the way to pass, a bit like an ambulance going through the traffic or something. The man ran up swiftly, and catching a piece of rice from the king's dish, he put it in his mouth. The swordsman drew his sword to cut the man's head off, but the king stopped him. "Smite not," said he. Then to the man he said, "Fear nothing, eat on." The man washed his hands and sat down and continued eating the meal. So after the meal the king caused his own drinking water and betel nut to be given to the man, and then said, "Now my man, you had tidings," he said. "What are those tidings?" And the man said to the king, "King, I am a messenger from lust and the belly. Lust says to me, go, and sent me here as her messenger. And with these words he spoke the first two stanzas. O king, the belly's messenger you see. O lord of chariots, do not angry be. For belly's sake men very far will go, even to ask favour of a foe. O king, the belly's messenger you see. O lord of chariots, do not angry be. The breath holds beneath his puissant sway. How do you say that?
Puissant.
Meaning... Refined, perhaps, yeah. If it's a French word, it must mean something like that. All men upon the earth, both night and day. When this the king heard, he said, that is true. Belly messengers are these. Urged by lust, they go to and fro, and lust makes them go. How well has this man put it? And he was pleased with him, and uttered the third stanza. Brahman, I give you 1,000 red cows as present to thee, thereto the bull, and also the bull for compliment. One messenger may to another give, for belly's messengers are all that live. And so said the king, and continued, I've heard something I never heard before or thought of, said by this great man, and so pleased with he that he showered honours upon him. So the Buddha said, the greedy man was the monk in the present day, and I was the king dainty. So that's a very nice little story, but the most interesting thing about it, of course, is that he got so well rewarded for being greedy, yeah, in the past life. It's supposed to be a moral tale. It actually, not only did he have a nice meal, he got to have a chat with the king, and then got 1,000 cows out of it. So it's a nice little morality tale on the virtues of greed. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it just says you had your head cleft, but whether that's might be a mistake in the translation or what. Yeah. Well, more likely the other way around. More likely it was it's actually a funny story, and then it got adopted as a morality tale. But maybe the monks were so serious about it they didn't get the joke. I don't know. So anyway, there's one little story. What does that tell us about... does that tell us anything interesting about masculine psychology? Well, I think it was pretty tasty. I think so. Yeah.
Something more status.
It's pretty basic.
It's so fashion, isn't it? With the women, it was always long and.
Yeah, it's more instant gratification kind of thing, isn't it? Yeah. So yeah, well, he's very active in getting it, isn't he? That's right. It's not, well, it's pretty clever, though. It's got, yeah, I think it's pretty clever. It's a bit more like the chaser or something. Okay, so look, here's another one. The Bilara Jataka. Let's see if this one's all relevant. Okay, this is about a monk who is a hypocrite, and he said this is not the first time he was a hypocrite, it was the same in times gone by. Now, once upon a time when Brahmadatta was reigning in Benares, the Bodhisattva was born as a rat, perfect in wisdom and as big as a young boar. He had his dwelling in the forest, and many hundreds of other rats lived underneath his rule. Now, there was a roving jackal who spotted this troop of rats and fell to scheming how to beguile and eat them. And he took up his stand near their home with his face to the sun, sniffing up the wind and standing on one leg. Now, seeing this, went out on his... This is India, remember? Seeing this, went out on his road in quest of food. The bodhisattva thought that the jackal was a saintly being and went up and asked his name. "What is your name?" to the jackal. The jackal says, "Godly is my name." "Why do you stand only on one leg?" "Because if I stood on all four at once, the earth could not bear my weight. That is why I stand on one leg only." "And why do you keep your mouth open?" "To take the air. I live on air. It is my only food." This is the world's first breatharian. "And why do you face the sun?" He says, "To worship him." And the bodhisattva thought, "What uprightness!" And thenceforth he made a point of going, attended by the other rats, to pay his respects morning and evening to the saintly jackal. So again, sort of sometimes curious behaviour of the bodhisattva in some of these stories, that he was so convinced by the jackal. When the rats were leaving, the jackal seized and devoured the last one of them, wiped his lips, and looked as though nothing had happened. In consequence of this, the rats grew fewer and fewer until they noticed the gaps in their ranks, and wondering why this was so, asked the bodhisattva the reason. He could not figure it out, but he suspected the jackal, and he resolved to put him to the test. So, next day, he let the other rats go out first, and himself came up the rear. The jackal made a spring on the bodhisattva, who, seeing him coming, faced around and said, "So this is your saintliness, you hypocrite, rascal!" And he repeated the following stanza: "Where saintliness is but a cloak, whereby to cozen guileless folk, and screen a villain's treachery, the cat-like nature there we see." The Jataka itself is actually called the Bilara Jataka, the cat Jataka, even though it doesn't actually feature a cat here. But the cat occurs only in the verse. So saying, the king of rats sprang at the jackal's throat and bit his windpipe asunder just under the jaw so that he died. Back came all the other rats and they gobbled up the body of the jackal with a crunch, crunch, crunch. That is to say, the foremost of them did, for they say that there was none left for the latecomers. And ever after, the rats lived happily in peace and quiet. So that was the bodhisattva there, who killed the jackal and got everyone to eat him up with relish. And interesting that the thing with the cat there, it says in the footnote here, it says that the Mahabharata version, Mahabharata has a version of this story, as very commonly the many other versions, not just the Buddhist one. And in that one, the jackal is in fact a cat. So again, so inconsistency in the way that it's structured, because the verses quite likely predate the actual prose text. Remember the first class that we did on this. So the verses is the ancient kernel of the story is like captured in the verse, which was used as a means of oral exposition by the storytellers. So that quite likely that's the actual oldest one. So originally it would seem that the story is about a cat, and it got turned into a jackal. The jackal's more kind of a cliched villain.
Is the jackal mentioned in the verse?
No. I don't know why a cat is supposed to be so hypocritical.
Well, it's why it catches rats and mice.
Ah, yeah. It would be the cat and mouse. It's a cat and mouse story, isn't it? Just like Tom and Jerry. But that's exactly it, isn't it? Okay. Yep. Well, and a murderer. Yeah, the only one of many stories where the Bodhisattva doesn't necessarily acquit himself as ethically as we might want.
Is he ever depicted as a carnival?
Oh, frequently.
Or a lion, or a
frequently, yeah.
Because you don't have a choice.
Yeah.
If you're an animal, that's what it's your nature.
Yeah, in that one he probably did have a choice. They could have just run away and gone somewhere else. Yeah.
Oh, but he was the ruler of the rats, and the rat, the jackal was eating all the rats.
Yeah.
In rat ethics, he might have had a choice.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. You never listened to Question Time at Parliament? You never listened to Question Time in Parliament? Rat ethics? Yeah. Okay. Another one. This one is a genuine one about the desires of men. All right. Okay. This story was told by the master while dwelling in a forest near the town of Desaka in the Sumba country. I've never heard of the Sumba. And for that occasion, the Blessed One said, and this is the Janapada Kalyani Sutta, which is in the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Satipatthana Sanyutta. Just as if, brethren, a great crowd were to gather together, crying all, to look at the bell of the land, look at the bell of the land. And just as in a like manner a greater crowd were together, crying, the bell of the land is singing and dancing. Here the bell means the most beautiful woman in the land, not the bell as in something that you ring, bell with an E. Is singing and dancing. And suppose there came a man fond of life, who feared death, fond of pleasure and averse to pain, and suppose such a one were addressed as follows. Here, you take this pot of oil, which is full to the brim, between the crowd and the most beautiful girl in the land. A man with a drawn sword will follow in your footsteps, and if you spill a single drop, he will cut off your head. What do you think? Would that man under those circumstances be careless and take no care in carrying that pot of oil? By no way, sir. This is a story which I framed to make my meaning clear, brethren, and here is its meaning. The brimming pot of oil typifies mindfulness of the body, and the lesson to be learnt is that such mindfulness should be practiced and perfected. Do not fail in this, brethren. So, when they'd heard this, the monk said, oh, that was a hard task for that man to pass by with that pot of oil without gazing on the charms of the most beautiful girl in the land. And the Buddha replied, that wasn't hard at all, brethren. It was quite an easy task. Easy for the very good reason that he was escorted along by one who threatened him with a drawn sword. But it was a truly hard task for the wise and good of bygone days to preserve right mindfulness and to curb their passions so as to not look at celestial beauty in all its perfection. Still, they triumphed and passing on won a kingdom. And so saying, he told this story of the past. Now, once upon a time when Brahmadatta was reigning in Benares, the Bodhisattva was the youngest of the king's 100 sons and grew up to manhood. Now, in those days, there were Pacheka Buddhas who used to come to take the meals at the palace, and the Bodhisattva ministered to them. Thinking one day of the great number of brothers he had, the Bodhisattva asked himself whether there was any likelihood of his coming to the throne of his fathers in that city, and determined to ask the Pacheka Buddhas to tell him what should come to pass. Next day the Buddhas came, took the water pot that was... So for those of you not familiar with the concept of Pacheka Buddhas, these were enlightened beings who, according to Buddhist theory, were born in a time when there was no Buddhist religion, and they would practice and realize awakening. In fact, it's a memory of the idea in ancient India that there are always sages who come and can practice and realize the truth, maybe independently of any religious affiliation. And so these Pacheka Buddhas, in the original version of this story, this would have just been a sage or something of some kind, but here it becomes a Pacheka Buddha, and they... generally, they basically live, practice meditation and so on. It's sometimes said that Pacheka Buddhas don't teach, but that's not correct. But they'll teach, but what they don't do is to set up a sasana, so they don't sort of set up a sangha and sort of establish all of the trappings to actually get the religion going, but they'll just give individual teachings to people. Okay, Now, the next day, the Buddhas came, took the water pot that was consecrated to holy uses, filtered the water, washed and dried their feet, and sat down to the meal. And as they sat, the Bodhisattva came and, seating himself by them with a courteous salutation, put his question. And they answered and said, "Prince, you will never come to be king in this city. But in Gandhara, 2,000 leagues away, there stands the city of Takasila. If you can reach that city in 7 days, you will become king there. But there is a peril on the road there, in journeying through a great forest. It is double the distance round the forest that it is to pass through it. Yakas have their dwelling therein, and Yakinis make villages and houses arise on the wayside. Beneath a goodly canopy embroidered with stars overhead, their magic sets a costly couch, shut in by fair curtains of wondrous dye. Arrayed in celestial splendor, the Yakinis sit within their abodes, seducing wayfarers with honeyed words. Weary you seem, they say. Come here and eat and drink before you journey further on your way. Those that come at their bidding are given seats and fired to lust by the charm of their wanton beauty. But scarce have they sinned before the Yakinis slay them and eat them while the warm blood is still flowing. And they ensnare men's senses, captivating the sense of beauty with utter loveliness, the ear with sweet song, the nostrils with heavenly odours, the taste with heavenly dainties of exquisite savour, and the touch with red cushioned couches divinely soft. But if you can subdue your senses and be strong in your resolve not to look upon them, then on the 7th day you will become king of the city of Takasila." To which the Bodhisattva replied, "Good sirs, how can I possibly look upon the Yakinis after your advice to me?" So saying, the Bodhisattva besought the Pacheka Buddhas to give him something to keep him safe on his journey. Receiving from them a charmed thread and some charmed sand, he first bade farewell to the Pacheka Buddhas and to his mother and father, and then going to his own abode, he addressed his household as follows, "I'm going to Takasila to make myself king there. You will stop behind me." But five of them answered. Five of his brothers said, "Let us go too." So just to remark here, there's a few of the classic motifs of the hero's journey which are coming up here. Is the distant goal to be attained, and then the perilous journey, the temptations to be overcome on the path, the meeting with the sage, the Obi-Wan Kenobi before setting out, the receiving of the magical talisman, the lightsaber, before you set out on the journey, and so on. So it's a kind of classic hero's journey, this one. In this way, it's a classic men's story, as a lot of the other stories we looked at were the classic women's stories. So when the brothers wanted to go, the Bodhisattva said, "You may not come with me, for I am told that the way is beset by Yakinis who captivate men's senses and destroy those who succumb to their charms. The danger is great, but relying on myself, I will go." To which his brother said, "If we go with you, prince, we would not gaze upon their baleful charms. We too will go to Takasila." "Then be said steadfast," said the Bodhisattva, and took the five with him on his journey. The Yakinis sat waiting by their way in the villages. And one of the five brothers, who loved beauty, looked upon the Yakinis, and being ensnared by their beauty, lagged behind the rest. "Why are you dropping behind?" asked the Bodhisattva. "Oh, my feet hurt me, prince. I'll just sit down here for a bit in one of these pavilions, and then I'll just catch you up." "My good man, these are Yakinis. Don't hanker after them." "Well, be that as it may, prince, I can't go any further." "Well," said the Bodhisattva, "you will soon be shown in your real colours." And he went on ahead with the other four. Yielding to his senses, the lover of beauty drew near to the Yakinis, who tempted him to sin and killed him then and there. Thereupon, the Yakinis departed, and further along the road raised by magic arts a new pavilion in which they sat singing to the music of diverse instruments. Now the lover of music dropped behind, and he was eaten in the same way. The ogresses went on further and sat waiting in a bazaar stocked with all sweet scents and perfumes, and there the brother who loved sweet-smelling things fell behind. When they'd eaten him, They went on further and sat in a provision booth where a profusion of heavenly... I'm tripping over my Victorian English again. Viands? Is that how you say it?
Yeah, that's things.
Produce and foods and things. Pronounced viands. It's one of these words I think I've probably only read in
Victorian novels.
Yeah. Viands, is it? Okay. That's good. Yeah, of exquisite savour was offered for sale, and there the gourmet fell behind. And when they'd eaten him, they went on further and sat on heavenly couches wrought by their magic arts, and there the lover of comfort fell behind, and him too they ate. So of course they each, the five brothers corresponding to the five senses. Yeah. Only the bodhisattva was left now, and one of the ogresses followed him, promising herself that for all his stern resolution, she would succeed in devouring him before she turned back. Further on in the forest, woodmen and others, seeing the ogress, the Yakini, asked her who the man was that walked on ahead. "He is my husband, good gentleman." Then the men called out to the bodhisattva, "Why, when you've got a sweet young wife as fair as the flowers, to leave her home and put her trust in you, why don't you walk with her instead of letting her trudge wearily behind you?" "She's no wife of mine, but a Yakini. She's eaten my five companions." "Alas, good gentleman," said she, "anger will drive men to say their very wives are Yakinis and ghouls." Next, she simulated, which is probably true enough. Next, is there like a snippet from the newspaper? Oh, that's right. I can't remember the details now. But there was a man attacked his wife and beat his wife up, and he was taken to court. And his defence was that she was so impossible to live with. So nagging and thing that he'd been dealing with it for 10 years, and he just snapped and gone mad and hit her and so on. And the testimony from the policeman was, after spending 20 minutes talking to his wife, he was just about ready to hit her as well. So it can sometimes be the case. Anyway, so he... Next, she simulated pregnancy, and then the look of a woman who had born, and then the look of a born of a woman who had just given birth, and with her child on her hip, she followed after the bodhisattva. Everyone they met asked the same questions about the pair, and the bodhisattva gave the same answer as he journeyed on. At last, he came to Takasila, where the Yakini made the child disappear and followed alone. And notice that the connection between the Yakinis and children is very, very common. At the gates of the city, the bodhisattva entered a rest house and sat down. Because of the bodhisattva's efficacy and power, she could not enter too, so she arrayed herself in divine beauty and stood upon the threshold. Now the king of Takasila was at that moment passing by on his way to his pleasaunce, the park, and was snared by her loveliness. Okay, so this is the... Remember, the bodhisattva was set out because he was told that if he went to Takasila, he would inherit the crown. And here is the existing king of Takasila, who saw the Yakini on his way out of the town. And he said to an attendant, "Go, find out whether she has a husband with her or not." And when the messenger came and asked whether she had a husband, she said, "Yes, sir, my husband is sitting within in the chamber." When the bodhisattva heard this, he said, "She is no wife of mine, she is a Yakini and has eaten my five companions." And as before, she said, "Alas, good gentleman, anger will drive men to say anything that comes into their heads." Then the man went back to the king and told him what each had said. And the king said, "Treasure is a royal royal resource." Okay, in other words, when treasure is found, like this woman, then it belongs to the king. And he sent for the Yakini and had her seated at the back of his elephant. After a solemn procession around the city, the king came back to his palace and had the Yakini lodged in the apartments reserved for a queen consort. After bathing and perfuming himself, the king ate his evening meal and then lay down on his royal bed. The ogress too prepared himself a meal and donned all her splendour. And as she lay by the side of the delighted king, she turned on her side and burst into tears. Being asked why she wept, she said, Sire, you found me by the wayside, and the women of the harem are many. Dwelling here among enemies, I shall feel crushed when they say, who knows who your father and mother are, or anything about your family you are picked up by the wayside. But if your majesty would give me power and authority over the whole kingdom, nobody would dare annoy me with such taunts.
He says what about the desire of the many.
To which the king replied, sweetheart, I have no power over those that dwell throughout my kingdom. I am not their lord and master. Interesting perception of kingship in those days. I have only jurisdiction over those who revolt or who do iniquity. So I cannot give you power and authority over the whole kingdom. That's a very interesting statement on the limitations of the king's power. Yeah? Then, sire, if you cannot give me authority over the kingdom or over the city, then at least give me authority within the palace, that I may have rule here over those that dwell within the palace. Too deeply smitten with her charms to refuse, the king gave her authority over all within the palace and bade her have rule over them. So this also relates to another kind of theme as to what the question is asked, like, what does a woman want? Okay, so I think it's even in the suttas that it raises that, what does a woman want? You see, this question which no man has ever been able to answer, and which the suttas say what a woman wants is isarya, which is very interesting. And that's exactly what she's asking for here. Isarya essentially means power or sovereignty. This is what a woman wants. And it was interesting, I was just reading a European folk tale about exactly the same question, and it's actually one of the stories from the King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. And he has to answer the question within a year. He has to find out the answer to the question: what does a woman want? Otherwise, he's going to have his head chopped off. And so this knight, of course, goes around asking everybody, and everyone gives him all these different answers as to what does a woman want. And of course, none of them are the right answer. But the real answer is she wants power. She wants sovereignty. Which is the same answer that's given in these suttas, and the same thing that she's wanting here. Is that true? Or exactly, yeah, exactly. Because they've been disempowered. Yeah, that's what they want. Is they want equality. And of course, that's exactly the criticism that's given to bhikkhunis, or people who want bhikkhuni ordination, isn't it? Yeah. All you want is worldly power and status and so on.
I am some marital research came up with men want respect and women want love in the relationship. And I think that's reflected in the Bible. Mm-hmm.
Well, it is a yakini after all. So, no, yeah, she's not a woman, but she's not a woman. She is woman with a capital W.
Yeah, but she's a king and a king. I mean, if he's a female form of a
yaka,
yaka's not a man.
Yeah, but No, that's true, but she embodies all of the worst aspects,
yes,
of femininity as the men see it.
And
yeah.
By men.
Yeah.
And like men thinking that women want power because they want
power. Hmm. And their projections are something. Okay. So the king gave her authority over all in the palace and bade her have rule over them. But it is actually, just to come back to that, it is actually said to be one of the virtues of a husband that he grants Isarya. Okay, so for the husband who grants sovereignty to the wife, that's said to be one of the virtues and one of the duties that a husband should actually do. What that seems to mean within a family context is basically that he will allow her probably to run the household. Yeah, basically, she's given the trust and the responsibility to be able to do things in the house without him telling her what to do all the time. That's probably what it means, in practical sense. Contented, she waited till the king was asleep, and then making her way to the city of the Yakas, returned with a whole crew of Yakas to the palace. Then she herself slew the king and devoured him, skin, tendons, and flesh, leaving only the bare bones. And the rest of the yuccas entered the gate, devouring anything as it came in their way, not leaving even a chicken or a dog alive. Next day, when people came and found the gate shut, they beat on it with impatient cries and came in only to find the whole palace strewn with bones. And they exclaimed, "So, the man was right in saying that she was not his wife, but a yakini. In his foolishness, the king brought her home to his wife, and doubtless she has assembled the other yakas, devoured everyone, and then made off." So, obviously, wise people there. On that day, the bodhisattva with the charmed sand on his head, remember that he was given these charms by the Pacheka Buddhas. So whether Pacheka Buddhas would actually give away these kinds of charms or not, but it's a sign that there's this continuity between this notion of a Pacheka Buddha and what probably in the original story was like some kind of wizard or sage or rishi or something like that who's dispensing magical things. Now on that day the bodhisattva with the charmed sand on his head and the charmed thread twisted around his brow was standing in the rest house, sword in hand, waiting for the dawn. Those others, meanwhile, cleansed the palace, garnished the floors afresh, sprinkled perfumes on them, scattered flowers, hanging nosegays from the roof. Glossary here?
Garland,
yeah. Okay. And festooning the walls with garlands and burning incense in the place. Then they took counsel together as follows. That man who could so master his senses as not so much to look at the yakini as she followed him in her divine beauty is a noble and steadfast man filled with wisdom. With such a one as king, it would be well with the whole kingdom. Let us make him our king. And all the courtiers and all the citizens of the kingdom were together on the matter. So the bodhisattva, being chosen king, was escorted into the capital and there decked in jewels and anointed king of Takasila. Shunning the four evil paths and following the ten paths of kingly duty, he ruled his kingdom in righteousness, and after a life spent in charity and other good works, he passed away to fare on according to his karma.
Is the story about carrying pots of oil with mindfulness part of the Sutta?
Yeah. In the Satipatthana Samyutta.
Is it typical that they pick out the theme from the suttas and then make it?
It happens from time to time. It's not a minority of Jatakas are like that, but there's a few. Yeah.
There is any special reason why the Jatakas stories always happen in the time of
Well, I don't know, there's only about 400 or so probably.
It's the same thing all the time.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just the
one time when Brahmadatta was reigning Benares, and one time when Brahmadatta was reigning Benares, and one time when Brahmadatta was reigning Benares. Yeah. All of those things, but actually, the reason is explained in the little article by Gregory Chopin. I don't know if you should be aware of that. I've discussed this in the Sutta classes before, but Gregory Chopin pointed out that in two vineyards that we have, Mahā Saṅgītha and Mula Sarasivāda, if I remember correctly. It actually gives instructions. The title of Chopin's little essay is called "If You Can't Remember the Sutta, Here's How to Make It Up," and it actually gives instructions in these vineyards on how to make up the details of suttas which you've forgotten. So it says that, for example, if you forget where the sutta was set, then you just say it was set in Savatthi. If you forget the name of the monastery, just say it was Jetavana. If you get the name of the king, you say it was King Pasenadi or Bimbisara. If you forget the name of the lay disciple, you say it was Visakha, or the lay man, you say it was Anuttapindika, and so on. And if it's a Jataka story and you forget the name of the king, you say it was Brahmadatta. And if you forget where it was set, you say it was in Benares. Okay? So, it's the default setting, exactly. Yeah. And of course you could liven the story up and so on, but the fact is that most people are too unimaginative to change the default settings. I remember that was some research done, this is in the 1980s, when they first introduced synthesizers that you could program. So you had this sort of set of pre-programmed sounds that you could make on a synthesizer, and then of course you had all these very powerful abilities to change and modify the sound as you wanted. And they were made by, I think it was Roland, the company that did this research. And then they sampled all of the synthesizers that were returned for service, and they actually found out that about, I think, 80 or 90% of them, no one had ever changed any of the default settings on the thing. So that's... All right, so that's that one. Now, 2:31.
If it was a man's desire to have power, it seems all right. But if it's a woman's desire to have power, it seems like it's generally viewed as it's not the right thing to want.
Well, yeah, certainly in that story, it was the Bodhisattva wanted to become the king, and that was regarded as something that's quite natural and normal and quite good. But when the Yakini wanted to become king, wanted to take her power, obviously it was something very abnormal, completely against the course of nature. Yeah, I think it's definitely something to do, something. Although having said which, you know, also to remember that, as I said before, that what the suttas actually say is that the husband should grant the power to the wife. Yeah, that's actually what they say. Yeah.
Should grant them the domestic power.
It just says Isaria, but presumably that's what it must have meant. Yeah, I mean they didn't have political power.
It's not about the queens and the suttas.
I mean, you have to be a noble wife husband in order to grant. This power to your wife, you see what he has done? He grants power and he's walking from place to big enough.
Well, yeah, there's a bit of a message in there, yeah.
But he wasn't using his
he granted her power because he was after
based upon unwholesome.
Yes, but he's unwholesome.
And the Yakini has no power at all until it's granted by a man. So even in the case of in the forest, she can't go attacking men until they are seduced and given to the power of the Yakini herself.
Yeah.
And even in the presence of the king, she still has to ask that for that permission to do something, to have control. And as soon as he gives that permission, then she's empowered to rip him apart, kill the whole palace.
Yeah.
So don't give women power. Is the moment. You give them permission, and it's just over.
There's a problem that occurs quite often with mythology when you mistake mythos for logos, or mistake what is essentially an internal story, and then apply a concrete external model to it. So the story about the Yakini is the projection of the male is the male imagination of the danger of the feminine. And as such, it's, you know, if you are to draw any kind of model from it, the internal model, it's like what you do in meditation. And it's actually quite dangerous if you mistake the internal for the external. So if you then start acting in the world according to that model, say, never give real women, you know, power, then that turns into a fundamentalist. But, you know, in terms of sitting in meditation, ignoring all your that's a good story. But it's that confusion
And that in this story that was quite explicit, because it was the five companions are clearly representing the five senses. Yeah, so it's that's by no means an artificial reading of the story. It's actually quite required by the story. Yeah, definitely. But so that's that level. But there's also I would read it also as having a more profound mythic level. And when that profound mythic, this particular one, as I said, many Jatakas don't have, or I can't find any mythic, truly mythic level to them. But on this one, it does. And we already noted that it has like the motifs of the hero's quest, which are there, which is also always one of the signs of that. And notice also the period of 7 days. Like he's given a period of 7 days, like a cosmic cycle. When there's a cosmic cycle, then he'll become king. And we also know that it's actually very common practice in ancient kingdoms for the king and all of his courtiers and so on to be buried underground. Or when the king dies, everyone in the kingdom will be killed. Yeah, and that's attested everywhere from Egypt through to China, where the whole court will actually be killed when the king dies. So, and often in mythology, the agent of death and the agent of change is depicted as the black side of femininity. So obviously in Indian mythology is Kali, yeah, who's the one who deals out death and so on. And in a mythological setting, then of course she's not by no means an evil deity. In fact, she's regarded as being very compassionate because she allows life to go on. And this is great. From Hindu myth of when Brahma, when they first created the world, because Brahma and his mates were so kind and compassionate, they didn't put any death into the world, and so beings just kept on breeding and multiplying and so on, and eventually the world just became so overcrowded that they couldn't bear it, and they said, we need to find a solution to this. And so they made, of course, the most compassionate of all the goddesses, which was death. And they told her, and Brahma said, this is your duty, you have to kill everybody so that there's room for new life to appear. And she was completely horrified, and they said, how can you possibly ask me to do this, you know, I can't do this job. And he said, no, this is your duty, you have to do it, otherwise life can't sustain itself. And so she just protested. She went off and just did all of these austerities and practices and rituals to try to persuade Brahma to change his mind. So she like stood on one leg for like a billion years or something like that. So, and trying to, her austerities were completely unrivaled, but Brahma couldn't be swayed. So eventually she had to accept her duty. So this is, in a sense, this is because it's connected with that notion of the 7 days as the cosmic cycles. So she's the instrument of renewal and rebirth. Yeah. So the actual story, even though it's full of death. But actually, at the end of it is the establishment of a new reign and a new kingdom and so on. So again, this is one of those stories which, if you read it on an ethical level, like on a sort of a moral fable level, then it tells you watch out for women because they're going to tempt you or whatever. And then if you read it on a psychological level, as Jason was saying, then it's a warning of the temptations of the senses, and it certainly invites a psychological reading. But then on a deeper level, again on a mythical level, it's an existential reading. It's talking about the nature of change, that death and new life always come in cycles. So I think all of those three levels can be read into that one.
And really, she's getting rid of the dross. It's kind of the point, you know, anyway,
well, exactly, yeah.
It's
the power of the evolution.
He also said to her that she couldn't give her the power, he couldn't give her the power of people in his kingdom when she didn't have that power. Yeah. But also, Bodhisattva needed a job.
Okay, so let's have a look at another one. This one, told about Devadatta, Devadatta having won favour in the eyes of Ajatasattu, yet could not make the repute and support which he had received last for any length of time. Ever since they saw the miracle done when Nalagiri was sent against him, against the Buddha, the reputation and offerings for Devadatta began to fall off. So, one day the bhikkhus were all talking about it in the Hall of Truth. Friend, Devadatta managed to get reputation and support, yet could not keep it up. This happened in olden days in just the same way. And he told them a story of the past. Once upon a time, Brahmadatta was king of Benares, and the Bodhisatta was his chaplain, and he had mastered the three Vedas and the 18 branches of knowledge. He knew the spell entitled of subduing the world. Okay, now this spell is one which involves religious meditation, probably not really meditation, but anyway. So the 18 branches are the 18 subsidiary studies underneath the Vedas. So you the Brahmins in that time would master the three Vedas, and then the 18 branches would be things like the grammar, phonetics, so the various linguistic studies, as well as the histories and so on and so forth. One day the Bodhisattva thought that he would recite this spell, so he sat down in a place apart upon a flat stone, and there went through reciting it. It is said that this spell could be taught to no one without the use of a special rite, for which reason he recited it in the place just described. It so happened that a jackal lying in a hole heard the spell at the time that he was reciting it and got it by heart. We are told that the jackal in a previous existence had been some Brahmin who had learnt this same chant. In other words, that's why, the reason why he could learn it all at the first hearing, because he'd already learnt it in his past life. The Bodhisattva ended his recitation and rose up saying, "Surely I've learnt that spell by heart by now." Then the jackal rose out of his hole and cried, "Brahman, I have learnt the spell better than you know it yourself," and off he ran. So just to come back here, this is one of the things that this shows us is the, and this is, comes up in a number of places, is how the Brahmins would actually practice their chanting. Yeah, so this is this kind of huge task which they did to memorize all the texts. You know, the Rig Veda has 10,000 verses. So to pass this down through the oral tradition, what they would do is they would go apart, they would go into the forest, they'd go into a secluded place where they didn't have distractions, where they could then concentrate on reciting and memorizing their texts. And of course, this being one of the practices which has been influenced the development of meditation. So the Bodhisattva set off chasing the jackal and followed in some way, crying, "That jackal will do a great mischief, catch him, catch him." But the jackal got clear off into the forest. The jackal found a she-jackal and gave her a little nip upon the body. "What is it, master?" she asked. "Do you know me?" he asked, "or do you not?" "I do not know you," she said. He repeated the spell and thus had her under his orders several hundreds of jackals, and gathered around him all of the elephants and horses, lions and tigers, pigs and deer and all other four-footed creatures, and he became their king under the title of Sabbadatta, or All Tusk. And the she-jackal he made his consort. At the back of two elephants, on the back of two elephants stood a lion, and on the lion's back sat Sabbadatta, the jackal king, along with his consort, the she-jackal, and great honour was paid to them. So of course this is all turning upside down the natural order, because the elephants and the lions should be the most noble animals. Now, the jackal was tempted by his great honour and became puffed up with pride, and he resolved to capture the kingdom of Benares. So, with all the four-footed creatures in his train, he came to a place near to Benares. His host covered 12 leagues of ground. From his position there, he sent a message to the king, "Give up your kingdom or fight for it." The citizens of Benares, smitten with terror, shut closed their gates and stayed within. Then the Bodhisattva drew near the king and said to him, "Don't fear, great king, leave me the task of fighting with the jackal king, Sabbadatta, except only me. No one is able to fight with him at all." Thus he gave heart to the king and the citizens. "I will ask him at once what he can do in order to take the city." So he mounted the tower of one of the gates and cried out, "Sabbadatta, what will you do to get possession of this realm?" And he said, "I will cause the lions to roar, and with the roaring I will frighten the multitude. That is how I will take it." Somewhat curious that he's giving away his plans so easily. Anyway, Ah, that's the plan, thought the Bodhisattva, and down he came from the tower. He made a proclamation by beat of drum that all the dwellers in the great city of Benares over all its 12 leagues must stop up their ears with flour. The multitude heard the command, they stopped up their own ears with flour so that they could not hear each other speak, and they even did the same to their cats and the other animals in the city. Bodhisattva went up a second time into the tower and cried out, Sabhadatta! What is it, Brahman? He said. He said, how will you take this realm? He said, I will cause the lions to roar and I will frighten the people and destroy them. Thus I will take it. And then the Bodhisattva said, you will not be able to make the lions roar. These noble lions with their tawny paws and shaggy manes will never do the bidding of an old jackal like you. So he's this is the taunting from the castle scene from the... I will taunt you a second time. not only will the other lions obey me, but I'll even make this one upon whose back I sit roar alone. Very well, said the Bodhisattva, do it if you can. So he tapped with his foot on the lion which he sat upon to roar. And the lion, resting his mouth upon the elephant's temple, roared thrice without any manner of doubt. The elephants were terrified and dropped the jackal down at their feet. They trampled upon his head and crushed it to atoms. Then and there, Sabhadatta perished. And the elephants, hearing the roar of the lion, were frightened to death and wounding one another. They all perished there. The rest of the animal, the creatures, deer and pigs, down to the hares and cats, perished then and there, all except the lions. And these ran off and took to the woods. There was a heap of carcasses covering the ground for 12 leagues. The Bodhisattva came down from the tower and had the gates of the city thrown open. By beat of drum he caused proclamation to be made throughout the city. Let all the people take the flour from out of their ears, and anyone who wants meat, then let them have some meat. So the people all ate whatever meat they could, fresh, and because there was so much of it, the rest of it they dried and preserved. And according to tradition, it was at this time that people first began to dry and preserve meat. It's interesting, the thing of the blocking of the ears, isn't it? Like Ulysses, mm-hmm. Past the sirens. Oh, because he won great fame, but the fame was his undoing. Yeah, fame and notoriety. So Devadatta was the jackal, yeah. Ananda was the king, and I was the chaplain.
So the lions are usually representative of the king of the beasts,
yeah.
The beasts.
Yeah.
So Devadatta to try and go against the Buddha would be, I think, more similar to the going against the lion. The lions are the only ones
who get out of it, yeah. This is the Asi Lakhana Jataka, the story of the auspiciousness of swords. Okay? Knowing the lucky signs of swords. This king was told by the Buddha while at Jetavana about a Brahmin retained by the king of Kosala because of his power of telling whether swords were lucky or not. We are told that when the king's smiths, it's a vocation, it's a certain aptitude which some people have. We are told that when the king's smiths had forged a sword, this Brahmin could tell by merely smelling it whether it was lucky or not. And he made it a rule only commend the work of those smiths who gave him presents, while he rejected the work of those who did not bribe him. Okay? So this is, again, this is a standard trope in all the Buddhist stories, that the Brahmins are just constantly corrupt and taking bribes and things, and that all of these superstitions and so on are just complete nonsense. Although they kind of vary, because very often in some stories they specifically say that all of these superstitions and so on are nonsense, but then in many others they actually, you know, that's actually the crux of the story, is the fact that the superstition or whatever actually comes true. But anyway, that that motif of the Brahmin being corrupt is very common. Now, a certain smith made a sword and put it in the sheath with some finely ground pepper, and brought it in this way to the king, who at once handed it over to the Brahmin to test. The Brahmin unsheathed the blade and sniffed at it. The pepper got up his nose and made him sneeze, and so violently that he cut off the tip of his nose with the edge of the sword. Yeah, obviously, yeah. Then this story came to the monks, and they told about it, and the Buddha heard about it. He said, "This is not the first time, brethren, that this Brahmin has cut his nose sniffing swords." The same thing happened to him in the past as well. Now, once upon a time, when Brahmadatta was reigning in Benares, he had in his service a Brahmin who professed to tell whether swords were lucky or not, and all came to pass as in the introductory story. And the king called in the surgeons and had him fitted with a false tip to his nose, which was cunningly painted for all the world like a real nose. Huh? So this is the world's first plastic surgery. Huh? Amazing, huh? He's got this fake nose. And the Brahmin resumed his duties again about the king. Now, the Brahmadatta had no son and only a daughter and a nephew whom he brought up under his own eye. When these two grew up, they fell in love with one another. Okay, so his daughter and his nephew fell in love. And the king sent for his counselors and said to them, "My nephew is the heir to the throne. If I give him my daughter to wife, he shall be anointed king." So again, this is another kind of classic mythic motif, is the intermarriage within the family. It's very common to find this within royal families, even up to the present day. Of course, that they still marry usually someone who's, I think, wasn't Lady Di and Prince Charles distantly related? I think second cousins or something. But on second thoughts, he decided that, as in any case his nephew was like a son, he had better marry him to a foreign princess, and gave his daughter to a prince of another royal house. For he thought this plan would give him more grandchildren and vest in his line the scepters of two several kingdoms. Okay, so he wasn't making any objection to the daughter and the nephew getting married as such, but he thought it would be more politically expedient to have them married separately. And after consulting with his counsellors, he resolved to separate the two, and they were accordingly made to dwell apart from one another. Now they were 16 years old, and they were very much in love, and the young prince thought of nothing but how to carry off the princess from her father's palace. At last the plan struck him of sending for a wise woman, to whom he gave a pocketful of money. "And what's this for?" said she. Then he told her of his passion, and besought the wise woman to convey him to his dear princess. And she promised him success, and said that she would tell the king that his daughter was under the influence of witchcraft, but that as the demon had possessed her for so long that he was off his guard, she would take the princess one day in a carriage to the cemetery with a strong escort under arms, and there in a magic circle lay the princess on a bed with a dead man underneath it, and with 108 cups of scented water wash the demon out of her. And when on this pretext I bring the princess to the cemetery, continued the wise woman, mind that you just reach the cemetery before us in your carriage with an armed escort, taking some ground pepper with you. Arrive at the cemetery, you will leave your carriage at the entrance and dispatch your men to the cemetery grove, while you will yourself go to the top of the mound and lie as though dead. Then I will come up and set a bed over you, which I will lay the princess. Then will come the time when you must sniff at the pepper until you sneeze two or three times, and when you sneeze we will leave the princess and take to our heels. Thereupon you and the princess must bathe all over, and you must take her home with you. Capital, said the prince, a most excellent device. Okay, so so has everyone got that plot? Is that clear? What's happening? The plot, yeah. So this is again sounding this kind of a lot of fairy tale kind of ideas. The princess lying on the bed in the magic circle and so on. And so okay. So a way, and then of course the whole thing, I mean, here it's the wise woman who does it rather than the Brahmin, but again there's no question of anyone actually believing that then these rituals are actually true. I mean, it's the people. The interesting thing is it's the people who are actually doing them who believe in them the least. Mm. Yeah? Everyone else believes in them, right? But the ones who actually do it, they know that completely. So away went the wise woman to the king, and he fell in with her idea, as did the princess when it was explained to her. When the day came, the old woman told the princess their errand and said to the guards on the road in order to frighten them, "Listen, under the bed that I shall set up there will be a dead man, and that dead man will sneeze, and mark that well, as soon as he sneezes, he will come out from under the dead and seize the first person he finds. Be ready, all of you." Now, the prince had already got to the place and got under the bed as had been arranged. Next, the crone led off the princess and laid her upon the bed, whispering to her not to be afraid. At once, the prince sniffed at the pepper and fell a-sneezing, and scarce had he begun to sneeze before the wise woman left the princess and with a loud scream was off, quicker than any of them. Not a man stood his ground. All in one they threw away their arms and bolted for dear life. Then the prince came forth and bore the princess off to his home as had before been arranged, and the old woman made her way to the king and told him what had happened. "Well," thought the king, "I'd always intended her for him, and they've grown up together like ghee in rice porridge." So he didn't fly into a passion, but in the course of time he made his nephew the king of the land, and his daughter was the queen consort. So, I mean, that story, it strikes me as being this is what they call an etiological myth, and basically meaning that there was probably a pre-existing custom, or in this case quite likely perhaps an image which required explanation, and the story was invented to explain that. So you may well have had some kind of custom involving like an image, like a sculpture with a princess on a bed, and then a man looking like he was dead lying underneath it, and then somehow the water being poured on top of it, and then people saying, what's all this about? How do we explain this? And so this story is given to explain away that. So this is quite a common way that that myths can be generated. I mean, it could be nothing more than that. It could be also that it relates in some way to genuine marriage rituals.
Could it be that lots of cultivars taboos against couples forming from such close relationships?
Yeah, yeah.
They might have done some sort of ritual to make it okay or something.
Could be, yeah, yes.
It's
one of the most basic taboos, yeah. Kinship laws. But the kinship laws aren't different in different places.
Yeah, and it's very close.
Yeah, I think it's quite likely, although, you know, you have to admit that within the structure of the story itself, it doesn't make it a problem.
No.
But it could well be that it was some way of negotiating that sort of kinship boundary, yeah.
I thought interesting the way the woman, she's called variously the wise woman, the old woman, and the crone.
Yeah.
Conjured up completely different. Crone is sort of not very complimentary.
Yeah.
Usually.
Yeah, yeah. And the old witch
is
wasn't
quite
it?
Complimentary.
Yeah.
Uses different terms, or if that's something that the Victorian translators have.
Yeah.
Been influenced by the European styles, where the story or the crone is the one who passes on stories or spells or evil intentions and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's quite likely just a translation artifact. I didn't bring the Pali text with me this afternoon, so I can't be sure, but yeah. Crone is used as just a word for, it's just a word used for an old woman, but yeah, it has quite a negative connotation. It's often like similar to like being, you know, you suspect that they're probably a witch, right? Once they have described as a crone.
Yeah. Specifically not, once women who've not had children. So it kind of
serves
a special function in society.
Oh, okay. A crone, specifically. Oh, I didn't know that. Is what's the origin of the word? Do you know?
Does it come from crony?
I don't know. Yeah, we can look at that.
Could it be possibly that you mentioned before, in terms of this is used to try to explain, you know, maybe like a hieroglyph or some statue?
Yeah.
And it was like the Chinese or the whole empire thing. So when the king dies, thus representing the prince under the bed.
Yeah.
And what else are you going to go to? Looking at his wife.
That could have been one custom. Yeah.
King, all
the libations. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's possible now. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, definitely very, you know, in that way, very related to the previous one about the Yakini with the, you know, the dead king and the princess and the kind of these motifs are so common in especially in very old mythology that you know, it's not implausible to read those kinds of ideas here. Okay. Sorry?
Where do they come into the cosmology? Are they in the animals realm?
No, they're in the realm of the four great kings. For the four great kings, one of them is the lord of the Nagas, one's the lord of the Yuccas, one of them's the lord of the Kumbandas, and one of them's the lord of the, what's the other one? The Gandhabas, yeah.
So that's below humans or above?
No, above humans.
Ah.
Yeah.
So the Yakas and the Yakinis are above human.
Yeah.
They're
celestials. Yeah. They're
beauty.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, if you're really good, you could be reborn.
That's right. Just keep on trying. But I mean, it's one of the things. Obviously, it's a conflation of different elements, yeah. And so those particular kinds are obviously very, you know, highly ambiguous, especially the Yakka and Yakini, and they're quite commonly are converted to Buddhism. And so, you know, you get a lot of Yakini conversion stories. I think that's probably why they're allocated in that realm, because the good ones very commonly became protective deities. And you find that very, very commonly throughout the Buddhist world. Yeah.
Have they mentioned much in Sutras?
Oh yeah, there's a Yakka Samyutta and things like that.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting to have others in the Yakkas can be either good or neutral or bad.
Yeah.
What's the other two?
Kumbandas, we don't really hear much about. And the Gandhabas, we explain that. And the Gandhavas is the celestial musicians. We haven't got to that bit yet. Alright. So the king, so he married, so the king got the two married, okay? Now the new king, so when he became the king, he kept on in his service the Brahmin who professed to tell the temper of swords, or the auspiciousness of swords. Okay, so remember that was in the introduction story, it had that, but it was also repeated in the beginning of the actual Jataka itself, that there was the Brahmin who had his nose tip cut off and replaced, and then kept on doing his job. Now, the new king kept on his service the Brahmin who professed to tell the auspiciousness of swords, and one day, as he stood in the sun, the false tip to the Brahmin's nose got loose and fell off. So presumably it was probably made of wax or something like that. Yeah? And there he stood, hanging his head for shame. Never mind, laughed the king. Sneezing is good for some, but bad for others. One sneeze lost you your nose, while I have to thank a sneeze for both my throne and my queen. You know? So saying, he uttered this stanza. Our diverse fates this moral show, what brings me weal may work you woe. So spoke the king, and after a life spent in charity and other good works, he passed away to fare according to his karma. So in this wise did the master teach the lesson that the world was wrong in thinking things were definitely and absolutely good or bad in all cases alike. Lastly, he identified the birth by saying the same world that the same man that now professes to understand whether swords are lucky or not professed the same skill in those days, and I myself was the prince who inherited his uncle's kingdom. So that's the moral of the story there, drawn out very explicitly. Yeah, the same thing in some cases can be good, in other cases can be bad. And I think that's probably a bit of a shot also at the Brahmins and the sort of telling of auspicious signs and lucky things. Yeah, they're saying, well, actually, it depends on what happens in the context sometimes.
How because these myths and stories are usually so heavily populated with men, when there are different messages coming from the different characteristics of the different male characters, we don't really know so much. Mm-hmm. They're just the characters.
Mm-hmm.
But every time a woman turns up, because there's like one woman out of every 100 characters, then we closely analyze it.
Mm. And the same thing with the suttas as well, isn't it? You know, the very few suttas proportionally spoken by bhikkhunis.
Yeah, we're just conditioned to accept ambiguity when it comes to manuscripts.
Yeah.
And it's really just an imbalance of voices. If there were just more female stories, we would just get used to the fact that it's ambiguous and it's messy and that's why.
Yeah.
Well,
there's lots and lots of female writers nowadays. Just to redress
the balance.
Just taking probably to read just one more for the time. Okay, so I'll read this story. Okay, so this one is an interesting sutta for a number of reasons, and particularly one of the ones that has the most mythical resonances and parallels of all the Jatakas. It just gives the introduction very briefly, and it concerns a layman who is lamenting after the death of a son, and then he told the story of the past. Once upon a time, a king named Mahakangsa reigned in Uttarapata, which Uttara means north, and Pata means way, i.e. he reigned in Norway, in the Kangsa district, in the city of Asitanjana. He had two sons, Kangsa and Upakangsa, and one daughter named Devagabha. On her birthday, the Brahmins who foretold the future said of her, "A son born of this girl will one day destroy the country and the lineage of Kangsa." The Kangsa being one of the ancient lineages of the kings. The king was too fond of the girl to put her to death, but leaving her brothers to settle it, lived his days out and then died. So, of course, this is one classic mythic motif, is the prophecy of the ending of the kingdom, reminding us of a lot of prophecies and myths and so on. Oedipus and many others. They thought that there would be an outcry. So when he died, Kangsa became king and Upakangsa became the viceroy. They thought that there would be an outcry were they to put their sister to death. So they resolved to give her in marriage to none, but to keep her husbandless and watch, and they built a single round tower for her to live in. Right, so, and the footnote here in the translation says that this, the story, the prophecy, the tower, and the result will remind the reader of Danae, who was one of the figures in one of the Greek myths, and it's a very similar story. Now, she had a serving woman named Nandagopa, and the woman's husband, Nandagopa, is a very interesting name for the serving woman. Nanda meaning delight, Gopa meaning the cowgirl, and, well, that being an extremely interesting name. For reasons which will become apparent shortly. And the woman's husband, Andhakavenhu. Andhakavenhu is also an interesting name. The word Andha meaning blind. Andhaka possibly meaning blind or possibly referring to the state of Andhra. But Venhu being the Pali pronunciation of Vishnu. Okay, so blind Vishnu was the servant who watched her. Coincidence, perhaps? At that time, a king named Mahasagara reigned in Upper Madhura, and he had two sons, Sagara and Upasagara. At their father's death, Sagara became king, and Upasagara was viceroy. This lad was Upakansa's friend, brought up together with him and trained by the same teacher, but he intrigued in his brother's harem and, being detected, ran away to Upakansa in the Kansa estate. Upakansa introduced him to King Kansa, and the king had him in great honour. Now, Upasagara, while waiting upon the king, observed the tower where Devagabha dwelt, and on asking who lived there, he heard the story, and he fell in love with the girl, of course. How could it be otherwise? And Devagabha one day saw him as he went with Upakansa to wait upon the king. She asked who that was, and being told by Nandagopa that it was Upasagara, son of the great King Sagara, she too fell in love with him. Upasagara gave a present to Nandagopa, saying, "Sister, you can arrange a meeting for me with Devagabha." "Easy enough," said Nandagopa, and she told the girl about it. So this again is motif of it's the old woman, the serving woman or whatever, who's always arranging all the liaisons and the backdoor kind of machinations that drive a lot of these stories. And because she was already in love with him, she agreed at once. One night, Nandagopa arranged a tryst and brought Upasagara up into the tower, and there he stayed with Devagabha. And by their constant intercourse, Devagabha conceived. By and by it became known that she was with child, and the brothers questioned Nandagopa. She made them promise her pardon, and then she told them about the matter. When they heard the story, they thought, "We cannot put our sister to death. If she bears a daughter, we will spare the baby. If she bears a son, we will kill him." And they gave Devagabha to Upasagara to wife. When her time came to be delivered, she brought forth a daughter. The brothers, on hearing this, were delighted and gave her the name of the lady Anjana. And they allotted to them a village for their estate named Govardhamana. Upasagara took Devagabha and lived with her at the village of Govardhamana. Devagabha became pregnant again, and on that very day Nandagopa conceived as well. Okay, so the servant woman also conceived, as it happened, on the very same day. And when their time was come, they gave birth on the same day. But this time, Devagabha had a son, and Nandagopa had a daughter. But Devagabha, in fear that her son would be put to death, sent him secretly to Nandagopa and received Nandagopa's daughter in return. They told the brothers of the birth, and the brothers said, "Was it a son or a daughter?" They asked. "It was a daughter," was the reply. "Then see that it is reared," said the brothers. In the same way, Devagabha bore 10 sons and Nandagopa 10 daughters. The sons lived with Nandagopa and the daughters with Devagabha, and no one knew the secret. All right? So again, like a lot of these stories revolves around the idea of succession and parentage and so on. It's very unusual to have the confusion about the matrilineal succession. Yeah, very common to have the confusion about who was the father. Okay, so this one is always doubtful, but to have the confusion about who was the mother is relatively unusual, and obviously required not only great cunning and skill, but an extremely remarkable series of coincidences as well to be able to pull it off. Obviously not, yeah, you're quite right, yeah. Okay, now the sons, right? So these sons who had such a curious parentage, yeah, who were born of this marriage of royal families from this girl who was prophesied to end the kingdom and was brought up in a round tower as this princess, and then who were swapped so mysteriously at birth so no one knows anything about them, and who are under threat of imminent death from their close relatives if anything is revealed. These sons, first one is called Vasudeva. The second called Baladeva, the third Chandadeva, the fourth Suryadeva, Agideva, Varunadeva, Arjuna, Pajuna, Gatapandita, and the tenth is called Ankura. They were known as the sons of Andhakavenhu, the servant, the ten slave brethren. Now these are very interesting names and give an idea of the origin or the connections of this particular story, and especially starting with Vasudeva. So anyone know who Vasudeva is? Yeah, they're all in there in Indian mythology. Vasudeva is the name of Krishna. Yeah, so Vasudeva is one of Krishna's titles, very common name. Yeah? So Vasudeva is Krishna. And this is why, of course, the relationship with Nanda Gopa is also very interesting, because as we all know, the most famous story of Krishna is his spending time playing around with the gopis, yeah, the cowgirls. Yeah? So this is Krishna's favorite exploits as a boy, was playing around with the cowgirls. So here his supposed mother is the delightful cowgirl, Nanda Gopa. The second one is Baladeva. Bala meaning strength, the power god. Now Baladeva is Krishna's brother, is Balarama in the more conventional Hindu stories. So it's just the same thing. So it's not just Krishna, but also Krishna's brother, Balarama. Okay, so let's go on here. The next one, Chanda is the moon, Surya is the sun, Agni is fire, of course Agni god. Varuna is the god of the heavens, the sky god. Arjuna is quite possibly Arjuna, as in the Mahabharata, the great hero of the Mahabharata. And Pajuna is also a name of a god, sometimes the name of the god Karma, it says here in the footnote. Gata Pandita, Gata possibly meaning ghee. Not quite sure what the meaning of that one is. And the tenth is Ankura, meaning a sprout, which is quite an interesting, is the name of the tenth. Sometimes the tenth, like the last child, is sometimes like the runt, yeah? Like the little one at the end. So maybe this is why it's called the sprout. I'm not quite sure of that. So I'm sure that there are a lot more connections here with the Hindu mythology, but that's probably enough to establish that anyway, that here we're dealing with a version of the one of the great Hindu myths, and remembering that actually in terms of timing, right? So here we have a version of the Krishna story. Now in terms of time, we also have a version of the Mahabharata story. We also have a version of the Ramayana story in the Jatakas. Okay, and now these predate any existing version of these stories from Hindu scriptures. Okay, so in all of these cases, probably the earliest actually literary form that we have them in is the Buddhist version. No doubt they existed prior to that, but the existing Hindu versions that we have were composed later. Okay, Now, in course of time, these 10 brothers grew big and very strong and fierce and ferocious, and they went about plundering. They even went so far as to plunder a present being conveyed to the king. The people came crowding in the king's courtyard, claiming, Under Kawenu's sons, the 10 brethren, are plundering the land. So the king summoned Under Kawenu and rebuked him for permitting his sons to plunder. The complaint was made 3 or 4 times, and the king kept on threatening him. In fear of his life, he craved the boon of safety from the king and told the secret, that how these were no sons of his, but of Upasagara. The king was alarmed. How can we get hold of them? He asked his courtiers. They replied, Sire, they are wrestlers. Let us hold a wrestling match in the city, and when they enter the ring, we will catch them and put them to death. So they sent for 2 wrestlers, Chanura and Murtika, and caused proclamation to be made throughout the city by beat of drum that on the 7th day there would be a wrestling match. The wrestling ring was prepared in front of the king's gate. There was an enclosure for the games. The ring was decked out gaily. The flags of victory were already tied. The whole city was in a whirl. Line over line rose the seats, tier above tier. So it wasn't just in ancient Greece that they had the big games that everyone would take part in. No? Chanura and Murtika went down into the ring and strutted about, jumping, shouting, clapping their hands. The 10 brethren came too. On their way, I mean, it's very kind of... hasn't changed too much. The 10 brethren came too. On their way, they plundered the washermen's street and clad themselves in robes of bright colours, and they stole perfume from the perfumer's shops and wreaths of flowers from the florists, and with their bodies all anointed, garlands upon their heads, earrings in their ears, they strutted into the ring, jumping, shouting and clapping their hands.
That's WWE.
It is, absolutely. At the moment, Janara was walking about and clapping his hands. Baladeva, seeing him, thought, I won't touch yon fellow with my hand. So catching up a thick strap from the elephant stable, jumping and shouting, he threw it around Chanura's belly and, joining the 2 ends together, brought them tight. He lifted him up, swung him round over his head and, dashing him on the ground, rolled him outside the arena. When Chanura was dead, the king sent for Murtika. Up got Murtika, jumping, shouting, clapping his hands. Baladeva smote him and crushed in his eyes, and as he cried out, I'm no wrestler, I'm no wrestler, Baladeva tied his hands together, saying, wrestler or no wrestler, it's all the same to me, and dashed him upon the ground, killed him, and threw him outside the arena. Now Murtika, in his death throes, uttered a prayer, may I become a goblin and devour him, and he became a yaka in a forest, I think it's a yaka, maybe a pisacha. Now I became a goblin in a forest called by the name of Kalamatya. The king said, take away the 7 to 10 slave brethren. And at that moment, Vasudeva threw a wheel, a chaka. This was a kind of a discus weapon, which is found in the Indic tradition. It's actually attested even in the Rig Veda, possibly one of the ancient weapons of the Aryans. Of course, in the West you have the discus, as the in the sports, and like the javelin and so on, it's originally descended from a weapon. At that moment, Vasudeva threw a wheel, a chakra, which lopped off the heads of the 2 brothers, okay, of the king and his brother. The crowd, terrified, fell at his feet and besought him to be their protector. Thus the 10 brethren, having slain their 2 uncles, assumed the sovereignty of the king of Asitanjana and brought all their parents there. So, you know, again, you have this kind of motif of the sort of the coming to power by means of slaying the original king, which, of course, and the fact that it was prophesied, sort of suspects. You know, this is again where you start to think that it's not just a story of someone who happened to kill the king, but it's a story of something which has some mythic necessity to it. Yeah? This is what a prophecy means. It's something which must come to pass. And so again, calls to mind the practice of the ritual regicide, which was very common in ancient India, and even up until the colonial era was still practiced, the periodic killing of the king. They now set out, the 10 brothers, intending to conquer all of India. In a while they arrived at the city of Ayodhya, the seat of King Kalasena. So of course Ayodhya being another classic very important town in Hindu mythology and said to be the birthplace of Rama. Okay, so both Rama and Krishna are said to be incarnations of Vishnu. And so we see we've already had Venhu as Vishnu was the supposed father who wasn't the actual father. We've had Krishna in there, and now we're going to Ayodhya, the birthplace of Rama. This they encompassed about, and they destroyed the jungle about it, breached the wall, took the king prisoner, and took the sovereignty of the place into their hands. From there, they proceeded to Dwaravati. Now, Dwaravati is a kind of interesting name, but Dwaravati is a classic city, in mythic city in Indian folklore. Dwaravati literally means possessing doors. The doory place. The word dwara is actually etymologically connected to door. So kind of interesting on a number of levels, but sort of having it's a place where you can get through there to other things. Anyway, now this city had on one side the sea and on one side the mountains. They say the place was haunted by goblins. A goblin would be stationed on the watch, seeing his enemies in the shape of a donkey, would bray as the donkey brays. At once, by goblin magic, the whole city would rise into the air and deposit itself on an island in the middle of the sea. When the foe was gone, it would come back and settle in its own place again. Okay, so that's a fairly sophisticated defense technique. This time, as usual, no sooner the donkey saw those 10 brethren coming than he brayed with the bray of a donkey. Up rose the city in the air and settled upon the island. And they couldn't see the city and they turned back. And then the city returned to its own place again. They returned again, the donkey did as before, and they could not invade the city of Dwaravati. Okay, so then they visited Kanha Dipayana. Okay, so Kanha being this being a sage who appears elsewhere in other Jatakas as well, and in fact was in the immediately preceding Jataka to, no, not immediately preceding, but was a few Jatakas earlier, Jataka 444. The Kanha Dipayana Jataka, and so he's the story of a great sage of those times. But Kanha being the Pali pronunciation of Krishna. Okay, so the sage called Krishna Dipayana. So again, whether there being some conflation of these myths with the Krishna legend, perhas. They went to Kanha Dipayana and they said, "Sir, we have failed to capture the kingdom of Dwaravati. Tell us how to do it." He said, "In a ditch at such a place is a donkey walking about. He brays when he sees an enemy and immediately the city rises in the air. You must clasp hold of his feet." In other words, you worship his feet at the foot of the donkey, and that is the way to accomplish your aim. Then they took leave of the ascetic, and all 10 of them went to the donkey, and falling at his feet, they said, "Sir, we have no help but thee. When we come to the city, do not bray." The donkey replied, I cannot help braying, but if you come first..." So again, this is this idea of turning the natural order upside down. Yeah. So we saw previously we had the jackal that was getting on top of the elephant and the lion. And in the Kusa Jataka last week, you know, you had the kind of the whole motif that both the king and the queen, or the prince and princess, had to completely humble and humiliate themselves, in literally lying in the mud and so on, before they would be able to take their proper role. Yeah? So there's always this idea of turning upside down the social order. And in this case, again, the princes, who've already been turned upside down a few times in their life, because they're actually born as princes, but then raised as slaves, and then became the kings again. But now even as kings, they have to go and humiliate themselves by worshipping at the foot of a donkey. Right? So, he says, I can't help it. I can't help but bray. But if you come first, and 4 of you bring great iron ploughs, and at the 4 gates of the city dig great iron posts into the ground, and when the city begins to rise, if you fix on the post a chain of iron fastened to the plough, the city will not be able to rise. Yeah? So they're going to chain the city down so it can't rise up into the air with iron. Yeah? Seems rational enough. Yeah? And one of the, but that's a very, very interesting motif, because what is that saying to you? See, here you've got a mystical city, right? A magical city, which will rise up and fly into the air because of donkey brains, yeah? What is it that stops the city from being magical? Iron, yeah? Which at the time that this was written about was a fairly relatively new innovation, a relatively new technology, yeah? In other words, it's technology, yeah? Which is stopping the magic. Yeah? That's what's tying us down. Yeah, that's what's stopping the magical from being magic, is the fact that that world is being chained down. Well, literally, yeah, very beautiful. Sometimes the images are so literal. The magical world is chained down and kept down to earth because of our technology. And so the iron being something which is like forced out of the earth with fire. So they thank him, and he did not utter a sound while they got ploughs and fixed the posts in the ground at the four gates of the city and stood waiting. Then the donkey brayed, and the city began to rise, but those who stood at the four gates with the four ploughs, having fixed to the posts iron chains which were fastened on the plough, and the city could not rise. Thereupon the ten brothers entered the city, killed the king, and took his kingdom. Thus they conquered all of India, and in 63,000 cities they slew by the wheel all the kings of them, and lived at Dwaravati, dividing the kingdom into 10 shares. Okay, so again, this you know, I think I mentioned in the first class on the Jatakas that the basic theme of all mythology is the ending of the divine. Yeah, the encroachment of technology and of human culture, and the ending of the divine in some way. So they divided the kingdom into 10 shares. Right? But they'd forgotten their sister, the lady Anjana. And they said, okay, let's make 11 shares so that she gets her portion. But Ankura, the sprout, the last of the 10 brothers, he said, give her my share. And I'll go to some business for a living. Only when I do my business in each of your countries, then I won't have to pay taxes, all right? Yeah. So this is the origin of the multinational corporation. They consented and gave his share to the sister, and with her they dwelt in Dwaravati, 9 kings, while Ankura embarked in trade. So again, very interesting, the relationship with the sister there, that she was forgotten, but she was actually given her portion. In course of time, they were all increased with sons and with daughters, and after a long time had gone by, their parents died. At that period, they say, a man's life was 20,000 years. Then, one day, a dearly beloved son of the great king Vasudeva died. The king, half dead with grief, neglected everything and lay lamenting and clutching the frame of his bed. Then Ghatapandita, one of the other brothers, thought to himself, except me, no one else is able to soothe my brother's grief. I'll find some means of soothing his grief for him. So assuming the appearance of madness, he raced through the whole city, gazing up at the sky and crying, give me a hare, give me a hare, as in a rabbit, not a head hare. All the city was excited. Ghatapandita has gone mad, they said. Just then a courtier named Rohineya went into the presence of King Vasudeva and opened a conversation with him by reciting the first stanza. So remember, Vasudeva being a title of Krishna, and but the word Krishna not actually used in the prose text, but when he's addressed in the verse, it says, Kanha, arise. Kanha, of course, as I've mentioned, being the Pali pronunciation of Krishna. So he's actually called Krishna in the verse, but not in the prose. Kanha, rise, why close the eyes to sleep? Why are you lying there, thine own born brother? See, the winds have borne away his wit, they've borne away his wisdom. The literal translation is his heart and his right eye. Gata, raise, O thou of the long black hair. When the courtier had thus spoken, the master, perceiving that he had risen in his perfect wisdom, uttered the second stanza. So soon the long-haired Kesava heard Rohineya's cry, he rose all anxious and distressed for Gata's misery. Up rose the king and quickly came down from his chamber, and proceeding to Ghatapandita, he got fast of him took him hold with both hands, and proceeding to him uttered the third stanza. Why do you wander around? Are you crazy and pacing around Dwarka all through and cry, hare, hare, say, who is there has taken a hare from you? To these words, the king, he only answered by repeating the same cry over and over again. But the king recited two more stanzas, be it of gold or made of jewels fine, or brass or silver, as you may incline, shell, stone, or coral, I declare, I'll make a hare. And many other hares there be that range the woodland wide, they shall be brought, I'll have them caught. Say, which do you decide? On hearing the king's words, the wise man replied by repeating the sixth stanza. I crave no hare of earthly kind, but that within the moon. Oh, bring him down, O Kesava, I ask no other boon. Right, so he wants the rabbit from the moon. Okay, so of course the story of the rabbit in the moon is told in another Jataka, Jataka 3:16. Okay, undoubtedly my brother has gone mad, thought the king when he heard this in great grief. He repeated the seventh stanza. In sooth, my brother, you will die if you make such a prayer and ask for what no man may pray, the moon's celestial hair. Gatapandita, on hearing the king's answer, stood stock still and said, my brother, you know that if a man prays for the hair in the moon and cannot get it, he will die. Why then do you mourn for your dead son? If Kanha, this you know and can console another's woe, why are you mourning still the son who died so long ago? Then he went on, standing there in the seat, and I, brother, pray only for what exists, but you are mourning for what does not exist. Then he instructed him by repeating two more stanzas, because obviously the rabbit in the moon exists, right? Whereas the dead son doesn't, okay? My son is born, let him not die, no man or nor deity can have that boon, then wherefore pray for what can never be? Nor mystic charm, nor magic roots, nor herbs, nor money spent can bring to life again that ghost whom Kanha you lament. The king on hearing this answered, your intent was good, dear one. You did it to take away my trouble. Then in praise of Gatapandita he repeated four stanzas. Men had I, wise and excellent, to give me good advice, but how hath Gatapandita opened this day mine eyes? Blazing was I as when a man pours oil upon a fire, thou didst bring water and didst quench the pain of my desire. Grief for my son, a cruel shaft, was lodged within my heart. Thou hast consoled me for my grief and taken out the dart. That dart extracted, free from pain, tranquil calm I keep. Hearing, O youth, thy words of truth, no more I grieve nor weep. In this way was Vasudeva consoled by Prince Gata. As to the lapse of a long time during which he ruled his kingdom, the sons of the 10 brethren thought, they say that Kanha Dipayan is possessed of divine insight, let us put him to the test. So they procured a young lad and dressed him up, and by binding a pillow around his belly made it appear as though he were with child. So again, because the motif of the illusion, yeah, it's like the sons and daughters were swapped around in the marriage in the original story. Now the boy is being presented as if it were pregnant. They brought him into his presence and asked him, "When, sir, will this woman be delivered?" The ascetic saw with his divine eye that the time was come for the destruction of the 10 royal brothers. Then looking to see what the term of his own life would be, he perceived that he must die that very day. Then he said, "Young sirs, what is this man to you?" "Answer us," they replied persistently. He said, "This man, on the seventh day from now, will bring forth a knot of acacia wood." So he will give birth to a knot of acacia wood. "With that, he will destroy the line of Vasudeva, even if you should take that piece of wood and burn it and cast the ashes into the river." And they said, "Oh, you false ascetic, a man can never bring forth a child." And they did the rope and string business and killed him at once. They strangled him or hung him up or something. So they killed the sage. So a very curious kind of episode. Actually, they just sounds like they were just playing a game at the beginning. Yeah, that's just by dressing this boy, this youth up,
and try to make him pregnant. So again, you'll kind of wonder what was underlying the formation of the story, because it actually has such dramatic outcome from such a trivial origin. So they killed Kanhadipayana at once. The king sent for the young men and asked them why they killed the ascetic. When they heard all, they were frightened. They set a guard upon the man, and when the seventh day, so this being the young lad who was originally dressed up, when on the seventh day he voided from his belly a knot of acacia wood, they burnt it and cast the ashes into the river. The ashes floated down the river and stuck on one side by a gate. From there sprung an erica plant. I don't know what an erica is.
Heath.
Is what, sorry?
Heath.
Heath, is it?
Heath.
Oh, okay. Erica is heather, yeah?
Many, many
sorts. Okay, one day the kings proposed that they should go and disport themselves in the water. And so to this very gate they came, and they caused a great pavilion to be made, and in that gorgeous pavilion they ate and drank. Then in sport they began to catch hold of hand and foot, and dividing in two parts they became very quarrelsome. Alright, so they're going there, having some fun, blah blah blah, get a bit drunk, roughhousing, playing around, and then they start to get a bit serious. At last one of them, finding nothing better for a club, picked a leaf from the erica plant, which even as he plucked it became a club of acacia wood in his hand. With this he beat many people. Then the others plucked also, and the things as they took them became clubs, and with them they cudgelled one another until they were killed. As they were destroying each other, four only, Vasudeva, Baladeva, the lady Anjana, their sister, and the chaplain, mounted a chariot and fled away. The rest perished, every one. So it was indeed the end of the line. Now these four, fleeing away in the chariot, came to the forest of Kala Mattika. There Muttika, the wrestler, had been born, having become, according to his aspiration, a goblin. So you remember the wrestler who was killed earlier, and he said, I want to get reborn as a yakka. So maybe that's how the yakkas come, all these kind of strong guys, tough guys. Then he perceived the coming of Baladeva. He created a village in that spot, and taking the semblance of a wrestler, he went jumping around and shouting, "Who's for a fight?" and snapping his fingers all the while. So this motif that before they were clapping and now he's snapping his fingers. So this is something, again, you find it seems to have been an Indian custom. That's what people did in kind of anger and so on, was snap their fingers. If you remember in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, when the Vajjians met Ambapali, the courtesan, who just invited the Buddha for Dana the next day, and their chariots banged up against each other, and they said, "We're going to invite the Buddha for Dana," and Ambapali said, "I've just invited him, you can't do it," and then they snapped their fingers at her. So this seems to have been the custom as a sign of aggression. So snapping his fingers, Baladeva, as soon as he saw him, he said, "Brother, I'll try a fall with this fellow." Vasudeva tried his best to prevent him, but down he got from the chariot and went up to him snapping his fingers. The other just seized him in the hollow of his hand and gobbled him up like a radish bulb. Vasudeva, perceiving that he was dead, went on all night with his sister and the chaplain, and at sunrise arrived at a frontier village. He lay down in the shelter of a bush and sent his sister and the chaplain into the village with orders to cook some food and bring it to him. A huntsman, his name was Jara, meaning old age, noticed the bush shaking, and he was thinking, "Oh, it must be a pig in the bush," and threw a spear and pierced his feet. So it pierced Vasudeva's feet. "Who has wounded me?" cried out Vasudeva. The huntsman, finding out that he had wounded a man, set off running in terror. The king, recovering his wits, got up and called the huntsman, "Uncle, come here, don't be afraid." When he came, he said to him, "Who are you?" "My name is Jara, my lord." "Ah," thought the king, "Vasudeva, whom old age wounds will die, so the ancients used to say, without doubt I must die today." Then he said, "Fear not, uncle, come, bind up my wound." The mouth of the wound bound up, the king let him go. Great pains come upon him, he could not eat the food that the others brought. Then addressing himself to the others, Vasudeva said, "This day I am to die. You are delicate creatures and will never be able to learn anything else with a living, so learn this livelihood from me." So saying, he taught them a craft and let them go, and then he died immediately. And thus excepting the lady Anjana, they perished, every one, it is said. So, also very interesting, and that particular motif is also definitely from the story of Krishna, and Krishna himself died from having a wound in his foot. And again, very common mythic motif, learned from Achilles and many others. And again, it's very interesting that the daughter was the firstborn, and in a sense, she was the only unproblematic one. You know, when she was born, that everyone was quite fine. The 10 brothers, and then all this kind of stuff happens, and they're taking over kingdom and conquering the whole of India and dividing it all up, and war and conflict and blah blah blah. And at the end of it, they're all dead, and then she's the only one left.
What happened to Bill Blake? Well,
that's actually a good question. Yeah. Well, he disappears out of the story. Yeah.
He
doesn't.
He was probably.
No.
He slipped through the dragon much earlier on with 18 minutes going to happen.
And he got out, yeah. Where's it?
Some franchises. McDonald's or something.
Well, she, the sister, was raised by her own mother. Mm-hmm. The brothers obviously were angry and mistakenly bullied and rejected by their mother.
Right.
And after that, the child. And I'm the poor person.
The interesting thing about these prophecies is that actually the whole reality exists because of the prophecy. It doesn't even exist without it, so it's not prophesied. I think it's not seeing the future, it's actually creating the future.
Yeah.
And then also the which says it's necessity.
Yeah.
Actually, by saying it, you actually create.
Yeah. And that, and I think that itself is very largely actually a subconscious outcome of the consistency of the storytelling, because the story's been told to everyone since they were kids, so you always hear the story, so you always know what the outcome of the story is going to be. Yeah, so actually in the subconscious of the people who are listening and telling the story, they always know what the outcome is. Yeah.
Won't their subconscious think, well, if they killed the daughter in the first place, then all this wouldn't have happened? Or if they didn't listen to him, you know, like instead of putting her in the tower and then.
Yeah.
So you get like, which is what, you know, that's what happened in the Greek thing, you know, they didn't sort of mind killing their daughters with a prophecy to. Trouble.
Sometimes, yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
They kept being really soft.
Yeah, that's true. But that is something that's characteristic of Greek mythology. I mean, it's probably a bit overstating to say they didn't mind. I mean, you've got Agamemnon sacrificing Iphigenia, but they minded, but they did it anyway.
Yeah.
The Greek mythology specifically seems to be the most brutal. I think Karen Armstrong writes about that in her book on mythology, that if you look at the sort of a comparable motif that's handled in different ways in different mythologies, the Greek one is always the most sort of perverse and violent and bizarre. Mm. Yeah, I mean, just to say one thing, like say the battle between the Titans and the gods. You know, in the Indian mythology, it's been saying the Buddhist mythology, that's so gentle. You know, we've already seen it's almost kind of, it's kind of laughably gentle. The devas say, oh, we can't go, we're going to run over these little birds, we have to turn our chariots around. You know? And then the Asuras say, oh no, they're turning around, they must have reinforcements, so we'll have to run away. So everyone's sort of being the first to run away from each other. Whereas in the Greek myth, the same story is told, essentially the same conflict is told, but it's exceedingly violent. You know, there's people being decapitated and all kinds of things. So, yeah.
Even the 10 brothers, the fight, I mean, being with Erica, it's just a tiny, it's tiny enough to little plant. Mm. Like a pick a little sprig and it turns into a leaf.
Yeah.
It's quite weird.
Yeah, but that myth, that's also very That's another classic mythic one, and that relates to the whole golden bough story. And if you read the golden, because of the plucking of the branch, is of course the death. And that particular one is actually very similar to one of the key Nordic myths, and the death of who was it? Anyone know Nordic mythology?
No.
The death of, it was the great hero among the gods, and he's basically completely invulnerable. So again, the story is someone's invulnerable to everything except for one thing. So of course the actual reality of it is we're all invulnerable to everything except death, right? So death is always the one thing, yeah, no matter how it's depicted. But this particular god, I can't remember his name now. And they do this kind of thing. He's so beloved that they do this thing where the gods go round the world and they get a contract from everything in the world that they won't kill him. Yeah? So every plant, everything in the world, they go around and they say, you know, this we love this person so much, please, you know, you don't harm him. So everything in the world makes a contract to not kill this god. Right? But then they were kind of getting towards the end of the day, it's a Friday afternoon, getting ready to knock off time, and they thought, oh, mistletoe is just such a little thing, that could never hurt anyone, so we won't bother asking the mistletoe. Yeah. And so then, of course, it's Loki, the kind of the trickster, who eventually they play, and then they play a game where they want to prove that this, what's his name? It's not Odin. No, it's Baldur. Baldur's name is. Baldur won't be killed by anything, right? So they do one of these games. So they're playing a game. So they all get arrows and shoot them at him, and they just bounce off, and they get clubs and they hit him, and they get knives and they stick him, and everything just goes off, and nothing can hurt him because everything in the world is completely invulnerable. So all the gods are playing this game, and then Loki, the trickster, gets an arrow made out of mistletoe. And shoots it at him, and then of course kills him. So that's the one thing. So again, a very similar motif. Mm-hmm. The most humble plant.
An arrow and a mistletoe.
Oh, he's a god. Yeah.
No. Mistletoe.
It's floppy. Yeah. So that was one of the key myths in the Golden Bough. Yeah. Baldur. So at that, and then the identification of the birth is interesting at that time. And then the moral of the story again, to the lay brother, he says, thus people have got free from grief for a son by attending to the words of wise men of old. So do not you have grief for the son. So out of all of that whole story and all of that complexity and all of those different episodes and things like that, it's actually just the one thing, is the grief for his son. So maybe the rest of it just distracted him, so he's trying to follow the story for the rest of it and forgot about his son or something. But you know, again this tendency of the Jatakas, because the conscious message is a moral. And so he wants to tell this moral of the story, which is, you know, death happens to us and we should let go of it, which of course is a very, very good Dhamma message. And then all of this other stuff is underlying it. He declared the truths, the Four Noble Truths, and identified the birth. Now in that birth, Ananda was Rohineya, who was the king's advisor or something like that. And Sariputta was Vasudeva. So Sariputta was Krishna in his past life. And the followers of the Buddha were the other persons, and I myself was Gatapandita. He was the wise brother who gave the advice about the... he was the one who pretended to be mad?
Yes, was he the one that didn't become a king?
No, that was Ankura. And another one, yeah. It doesn't say, but conquered all those towns and everything like that. So, gone over 6 o'clock. So let's finish up by paying respects.